The world is changing at breathtaking speeds, with trends and fads popping up and passing away at breakneck pace. Against that backdrop of nearly constant upheaval, we welcome you to the Sunday Scotch Society. Yeah, yeah. Over delectable, sumptuous scotches and with the occasional good cigar in hand, we have open, honest, and uninhibited conversation about whatever strikes our fancy. Whether it's the critical issue of the day or a deep dive down the rabbit hole, we take it all seriously while having a good time. Join us for a stiff drink and a great conversation. So welcome to this week's Sunday Scotch Society. My name is K. Quincy Parker. And today we are solo. It's just me and you. Matthew is in Eleuthera handling family stuff. And so this week it's just going to be me chatting with you. And I actually have a really special sort of treat. Well, I think of it as a treat planned for a little later on in the show. But this week I get to sip one of my new favorite single malt whiskeys. And this one is, it has a nice bit of story. It is a whiskey from Glenturret Distillery. And the Glenturret Distillery traces its history back to 1763. So it's been, you know, considered the oldest distillery, the oldest working distillery in Scotland. And they have an incredible legacy down through the years. The thing that has sort of made Glenturret stand out outside of its very storied legacy as a distillery is it was bought, I think, in 2019, I think, by Lalique, the owners of Lalique. And so they rebranded the bottling of this whiskey. And the Glenturret, I'll put a post up on our Instagram and on my personal Instagram, but just so you can see what a beautiful bottle it comes in. It's not Lalique Crystal, but it is a Lalique designed bottle. And the thing that makes this whiskey really special, aside from the age of the distillery and the wonderful art and artistry of the new bottling, is that it's almost like a boutique whiskey brand in the best sense of the word, in that its history has been tied to master distillers who really love its history and really respect the legacy of the Glenturret Distillery. Previously, it was known as the Hosh, and there was a name before that, but I think actually the Glenturret name was in the 18th century. But it is, it's a real, we respect the heritage type brand. And I believe that that comes through in the whiskey as you taste it. On the website for the Glenturret, it talks in the About Us section. It says, you know, as custodians of the Glenturret, we share a mutual pride and passion for curating unforgettable experiences. We will never forget our heritage, values, and artisanal methods. Yet we look to the future through innovation and industry-leading practices in an inclusive, progressive, and highly spirited working environment. Now, when I first brought this brand up on the show, I talked about how the attempt was being made to demonstrate that one can make world-class, fine, delicious single malt whiskeys and also run an environmentally friendly distillery and distilling operation, which is what the that is what drew the Lalique board to the Glenturret Distillery, is that that's what they were trying to do. And so it's very, when they talk about being progressive, you know, that is what was interesting about them from a pure politics point of view. But as a person who enjoys the dram, a person who is about what is in the bottle, I think what is most important about the Glenturret is the way it tastes. And so what we're going to be drinking on the show today is the Glenturret 10-year-old peat smoked offering. They have a couple of different ones that are available in town. I know Jimmy's has the 7-year-old, this 10-year-old, and Jimmy's also has a triple wood, I believe. And I am hoping that we will soon begin to see some of their other offerings. They have a 12, a 14, and a 15-year-old. Of course, they have some limited releases that are a little, I guess, older in some cases, and distilled with different techniques. But that's kind of the range. The triple wood, 7, 10, 12, and 15-year-olds. And I hope that we get to see all of them here in Nassau, or here in the Bahamas, as the case may be. There's also a 14-year-old peat smoked that I'm really excited to get to try. So anyway, I am now, in Matthew's honor, going to do what we call the thing. Oh my goodness. So right away, just as you open it and pop the cork and pour it into the tumbler, the thing about the Glenturret 10-year-old peat smoke is anything that puts peat smoke in the name is trying to tell you something, right? About what to expect, what kind of flavor profile it's going to have. And in this instance, the first thing that you get on the nose is that peat. It smells like heather. It smells like grass. It smells, you know, it's very green and earthy. And then there's, right after the green earthiness, there's a rich smokiness in the aroma, and the 10-year-old is kind of like a really nice copper color, and I can smell the smoke. There's nothing really outside of the peat and the smoke on the nose, because I mean, well, I don't know if maybe I'm a little stuffed up, or maybe somebody else might pick something else up. But the thing that's really surprisingly absent is the ethanol burn. You know, like a good number of the single malt whiskeys and the bourbons that we've tasted here on the Sunday Scotch Society have that ethanol burn because they're so potent in terms of the alcohol by volume. But I don't get any alcohol burn on this at all, so I can't really justify waiting to sip this. So here we go with my first sip. All right, so the first thing, what a finish. So the first thing that I get on the Glenturret's, The first thing that I get on the palate is the smoke. It is not burning. The smoke is just coming through. It's inundating. I'm almost certain that just, yeah, it's the smoke. And then the next sort of real impression is a fulfillment of that earthiness, and it's like you're getting, I don't know if you, well, this may come across strangely to you, but if you know the earthiness of mushrooms, that's kind of the flavor profile that I'm picking up here. So it's a smoky sort of aromatic smoke, and then a hint of earthiness from almost like a mushroomy type earthiness and fullness, and then it kind of mellows out into, it's not sweet at all, but it is, it's very round. It has a wonderful mouthfeel. I'm going in for sip number two. Oh, yeah. The second sip, really, it's starting to emphasize the peat smoke. And there's a little, almost like a not sweet candy flavor towards the middle of it as it sits on the palate, which I believe is going to probably become more accentuated as I sip the dram. And then the finish is so long, and you feel it. It's almost moving down my chest like warm molasses. Without this, you know, that's just how the texture feels. It's not a molassesy flavor. Like I say, my main impression of it is smoke, the mushroomy kind of earthiness, a little candy without any sweetness. Yeah, this is a very different sort of character for a single malt scotch, especially a Highland scotch. So this is so interesting. I like this a lot. Anyway, so I want to get to our special feature for today. So on Friday, the 4th of April, distinguished economist and friend of the pod, Therese Turner-Jones, was the featured speaker for a webinar hosted by the Organization for Responsible Governance, or ORG, as part of that group's Be Clear program. And as part of her introduction, Therese pointed out that it's important that citizens be able to understand what the administration is trying to do and how. But what she said that stuck out to me was how vital it is for Bahamians to be able to, quote, trace the money, unquote. She points out that we're all paying taxes, and the citizen wants to know where that money ends up and whether we're getting value for money. Therese has worked all over the world, including Washington, D.C., Jamaica, Guinea, and West Africa, and Barbados. She's worked for the Inter-American Development Bank, the Caribbean Development Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, as well as private sector. So her bona fides are unquestionable. So in this presentation, Therese offered critical reflections on the Bahamas' mid-year budget, highlighting key economic trends and future fiscal developments. And I thought her commentary and insight were fascinating, so I decided to share them with you as part of the Sunday Scotch Society. Therese is a friend, and I'm quite proud to admit, has been a colleague on occasion as she worked in the multilateral system. And so to say that I have profound respect for her as a professional and as a person is to understate it by quite a bit. She's promised to join me on the pod soon enough. But for now, I'd like to just present her thoughts from the org webinar on the mid-year budget. But before we listen to what she had to say, though, I want to highlight some areas where I think her commentary deserves special attention. So when you hear her start to talk about these things, I really want you to, you know, pay close attention here. She agrees that the Bahamas' economy post-pandemic is recovering quite strong, but she stresses that how that recovery feels depends on where in the economy you sit. I think that's a really key point. She talked about the 2% growth as anemic, and says that this anemic level of growth has been characteristic of the Bahamian economy for quite a while. She talks about, in the context of recognition that the economy is still extremely dependent on tourism, and accepting that it's not easy to diversify an economy, she talks about the fact that the Bahamas should have spent and should be spending time deepening linkages to tourism as a means to broaden the economy. I thought that that was a very interesting perspective. It reminded me a lot of what former Prime Minister Perry Christie liked to talk about. He used that phrase, linkages, to the tourism sector quite liberally. But I'm not certain that that translated into policy. But in any event, speaking on tourism, Teresa raised the concern about the fact that there's a demonstrated inability to expand the stock of hotel rooms here in the Bahamas, which itself presents constraint to potential growth from the tourism sector. She talked about revenue being up, but spending being up more. And just a note here, in the mid-year budget, the government's calculation says that wages and salaries that represents 23% of total spending. Interest payments represents 21% of total payments. And subsidies to, you know, semi-government agencies and whatnot represents 14% of spending. And she said that capital spending, which is about 3%, is not enough. Her commentary on this area, I think, is fascinating. And I encourage you to really, really perk up your ears on that. She talked about the risks, you know, natural disaster and climate change as risks to our economy. And she had a really interesting point about when the Bahamas government drew down money from the IDB on it, but had to return the money. She also talks about the tariffs, you know, which I guess unsurprisingly, she says, will hit the Bahamas very, very, very hard. So her commentary on that is also very interesting. So anyway, without further ado, here's Therese now. Therese Turner-Jones, international economist. She begins with an overview of the Bahamian economy, and we are incredibly proud to have Therese join us by reflection here on the Sunday Scotch Society. Here she is now.
The first place to look for how well we're doing, of course, is the latest IMF Article 4 consultation. I think a lot of people have on this call would be familiar with those reports that come out annually. And a lot of the sort of global context, some of the issues affecting our economy are picked up by the PM in the narrative and in his statement in terms of what's affecting us. But I think the headline pieces are pretty interesting in terms of we're really in a full-blown, what I would call the post-pandemic recovery is quite strong. It continues to be strong, not just in tourism, but I think throughout the economy, we see that. Now, of course, like a lot of countries that are coming out of COVID, on the one hand, where the numbers look encouraging, the individual consumer or households may be feeling a bigger pinch. And so I think I'm always very conscious about how we portray what's happening in the economy just because it depends on which quintile in the income bracket you fall. So I think if we keep that in the back of our minds, that how it's affecting various income levels throughout the economy is very different from, and so some of these statements which come across as being, wow, that sounds overly optimistic. I think when we drill down to people who are basically recovering from the loss of two jobs back in 2020, both household earners, if you had two household earners losing jobs at that time, mortgages being a little bit underwater, not a little bit, a lot underwater, the post-inflationary period in this recovery, I think, driven by lots of other factors, you know, Ukraine crisis and other things. And now we have something else that we'll all discuss later on. But I think it's really important to put ourselves in the shoes of everybody across the income spectrum of the Bahamas. And I think that's why a discussion like this is really important. So, you know, on paper, not just on paper, but I think also in reality, we see a lot of encouraging signs of the Bahamian economy. Even though, you know, a 2%, 1.5% GDP real growth rate doesn't sound like a lot, and it isn't, I call it an anemic level of growth. And that anemic level of growth really, though, has been sort of something has been characteristic of the Bahamian economy for quite a while. Obviously, during COVID, there was that large fall off. And now, and then there was a double digit pickup in the early 2021, 2022. And now we're seeing sort of an adjustment to the mean, which is around 1.52% of the Bahamian economy. Now, yeah, that's okay, but it's not fantastic. But it's driven, again, mostly by tourism. One of the, having left the Bahamas for many years and coming back after 30 years and seeing the fact that the economy, to me, seems to be still extremely heavily dependent on tourism as a driver, suggests, and that I'm not thinking that this is easy to do, because in my own work over these decades working across this region, it's not easy to diversify an economy. But I think what is probably the most disappointing aspect of how we've capitalize on our tourism dividend. And I think we are really, the Bahamas is in a better strategic position to take advantage of tourism than a lot of other countries in the Caribbean, just because of its proximity to the United States, where we get most of our visitors. And that may come to bite us later on. But I think that strategic geographical position, which we have exploited for decades, We could have spent, and I think my view is we should be spending more time deepening those linkages to tourism so that we can, one, lessen dependence on imports, whether it's food or crafts or whatever it is, and while still maintaining a very high quality, internationally attractive tourism product. So that's my point on tourism. When I look at the fiscal position, just in terms of where the economy is going, it's also been improving, largely because of the horrific positions we started with at the beginning of the pandemic, or during the pandemic, when the debt to GDP hit 100% or close to 100%. And now we're moving down towards 60% by in the forecasts. The government has it something like 27, 28. That's right around the corner, but that's where we really need to be. An economy this size, the narrow nature of our revenue base, we need to keep our debt within a reasonable level. And for countries of this size, that reasonable level should be around 60%. I wanted to just point this out, and I'm sure a lot of you have heard me say it at least one of the states since I've been back here, is that one of the things that the IMF highlighted in the report this year, I've also heard it come from officials of tourism, is that we really are, our potential to grow the stopover component of our visitors is constrained by the number of hotel rooms. And the fact that we haven't been able to expand our hotel rooms, there hasn't really been any major since Bahama. I think we haven't had any new major plants constructed in the Bahamas, at least not in Providence, where most of our visitors arrive, that is a constraint on how much further we can grow. And I think there are issues in the statement that support doing more to get more hotel rooms. And then I have to mention, as one of the important features of our economy, is we live in a hurricane-prone region where climate change, natural disasters, pose significant risks. We just have to go back to Hurricane Dorian to know how expensive that can be. And along with that comes, you know, considerations around how do you take out insurance for future natural disasters. And I must say, working with MDBs, IDB in particular, the Bahamas government has done a lot to put in place contingent credit facilities in the event that we have another such shock. And it's not if, it's probably going to be when. And then this broad issue of global uncertainty. Today, yesterday, I think we're all kind of still reeling from the news around tariffs, but I'll get to that later. Getting to the budget. Next slide, please, Vanessa. What did I pick up from the analysis? And it, you know, I must say, there weren't a lot of aha moments in there, but just sort of the data to buttress what I just described. You know, our revenues have been pretty hefty in the first 6 months of this fiscal year compared to last year, up by about 10%. VAT still continues to dominate the revenues. And I think, I don't know how many Bahamians know this, but the efficiency rate of VAT in the Bahamas is among the best in the world. We're close to 100% efficiency on VAT. That means that we have a broad-based VAT. The rate isn't too high. It's fairly easy to collect, and the government's collecting it. And that's very evident in the VAT performance this year. I think it's up by not a heck of a lot, 3% over last year, combined with trade taxes, which were up by about 23% over the same period last year. The fiscal target that the government set for itself, which is something like 23% of revenue at 23% of GDP, seems to be on target for the meeting by the end of this fiscal year. It's hard to tell from the data that was presented because I had to do those calculations myself. But I think at the end of the year, we'll find that we have hit that target. Meanwhile, though, our spending has moved much higher. So whenever we see spending going faster than revenues, we know what that means. That means that debt is increasing. And while the debt has been on a downward trajectory in the last year, we saw, and it comes out in the paper as well as in the data, there was some increase in the debt. Although on the positive side, I think we'll find, although again, because I couldn't find the six-month number, just the forecast for the whole year, the primary surplus is on track to be over 3%. So that's a good number, a positive I think it's 3.9 is the projected number for the primary surplus this year, which means that would allow the government to reduce its indebtedness by an equivalent amount. So we should see the debt coming down, and that seems to be the forecast going on for the next 5 years. So on the debt dynamics, what impressed me in this budget and in the paper is some of the initiatives that the government's taking on the asset liability side to either smooth out some of the payments, go to auctions on some of its issuances, tap the domestic market, although it continues, I think, to want to prefer, it seems to me, to go after commercial debt on the capital markets. Although I think in this instance, we see in this last 6 months, for this report anyway, an operation with the IDB was very instrumental in swapping out some more expensive debt for more concessional debt. And that's what they ought to be doing. That's a really good trend. On the capital spending side, again, if you look across the region, but especially in the Bahamas, we don't do a good job of allocating our capital budget very well. It's typically low as a share of GDP. 3% of GDP that the government's investing in infrastructure is not enough for an economy like the Bahamas and a country area. I think we still have a lot of infrastructure needs. This particular mid-year report talks about lots of roadworks in the Family Islands, lots of roadworks in New Providence, some school building and so on. Those are fine. There's also a lot of attention that the PM pays to, and we're going to get to that, renewable energy issues. But I think on the whole, if there is a disappointing aspect to what's happening, in the Bahamas is, you know, keeping that investment, when I get investment capital budget to be below 5-7. I mean, other countries in this region are up at 7, but typically it should be even higher for a country like ours that is emerging. So next slide, please. And I'm being told I have 4 minutes left on my clock. So just to say that I think the PM did a really fairly decent job in the narrative, the 29-page document, talking about what it is that they're trying to do with their fiscal policy. One, and I think for a group like this, we appreciate it, right? Improvements in fiscal discipline, transparency, and accountability. So it's one thing, though, to have those as big goals. I think it's another thing to be able to present information in a really usable and data-friendly fashion. So what I would say that if I were to anybody at our technicians at finance, in addition to doing this mid-year report, what I see other countries doing, most notably Jamaica, is to produce something that's called a people's budget, which is basically a budget for dummies, not that our people are dummies, but if you put it out in a way that maybe it's animated, maybe it's a graphic form, but you want to really communicate what's really happening to the spending and the revenues, where the revenue's coming from. If it's mostly VAT, if it's trade taxes, if it's property taxes, a lot of time was also spent in this, in the narrative part, talking about the role of property taxes and the need to go after especially the foreign bias of real estate in this country, to go after them in a way that more robust collection of those taxes, that's the best way to put it. I think what the government was alluding to was that perhaps there is a part of the market, real estate market out there that's, for lack of a better term, under the table and not being caught up in the tax net. So if Bahamian contribution to real estate taxes is 20%, that's, I didn't find that number troubling myself. I think the way it's portrayed in the document is that, well, we need to really go after the big guys. Yes, go after the big guys, but also I think what was missing in that explanation was a little bit more analysis. So when foreigners tend to have, you know, big ticket items, you know, million, 2 million, 15 million, $20 million properties, compared to average real estate transaction for Bahamian, let's call it, I'm going to use a round number, but it may not be, but let's call it 250,000. So, you know, 1,250,000, you're not expecting to collect as much taxes. So if the average Bahamian is paying 9,000, but the average foreigner is paying 100 and something thousand, that's fine for me, as long as they're paying. The most important thing is as long as we are collecting the taxes. So I think that's something for this group to think about. What we think about that and whether the way that Bahamians are incentivized, and I must say, I think offering an incentive to pay a property tax at a discount before the due date is one way to encourage people to be current on their taxes. If you, anybody on this call not doing that, well, I think we already passed the date, but March 31st was the deadline. You know, you can save a few hundred dollars by paying your property tax in advance and taking advantage of the 10% rebate. Now, it could be that there is more that could be done, given that Bahamians are contributing only 1/5 of all of those property taxes being collected. And if it is being seen by the government as an important source of revenue, then think about other incentives to maybe lessen the burden on Bahamians, because I think what is important, I agree everybody should be paying something on their property to the public purse, because things like roads have to be maintained. But if we're talking about reducing, and I'm getting to a point here that's also on this slide, which is one of the objectives of the government, is to lower the tax burden on Bahamians and on those least able to pay, then this is one area that I think we can think about. That was my time, but I've also noted that I can take extra time, so I'm gonna take advantage of the extra time. On strategic investments, and this is where the capital budget comes in, we note from the report and also from the PM statement that what's the focus, and this is no surprise, tourism, education, health, security, energy and infrastructure are mentioned a lot. But I go back to that figure, which is 3% of GDP that we spend on infrastructure is definitely not enough. So next slide, please. I think here is where we want to talk a little bit about what some of the challenges and what are some of the risks moving forward. And I think it became even more, it focused my mind more this week because of what's been happening in the US with the trade announcements. But just to say, I think we know what the main risks are in this economy: climate change, natural disasters. The report speaks to being able to improve the capacity of our natural disaster institutions. This is really, really important because we know that post-Dorian, the Bahamian government was able to draw down on the contingent credit facility that it had with the IDB, but it ended up actually having to return funds to the IDB because it couldn't actually reconcile all of the spending with the drawdown from the bank. So that means making preparations in advance, having procurements already ready, and not really scurrying around on the heels of the disaster to get this done. For those people who are experts in disaster management, you know, there are some things that just need to be done. Lots of planning, lots of organization ahead of time so that when it happens, we can monitor, we can respond, we can evaluate more quickly, and we can basically tap into lots of partners that the Bahamas has, IDB, World Bank, CDB, and so on, who can really help us do this. The emphasis on capacity building of these institutions really struck me as a very important tactic, and I'm happy to see that. Renewable energy looms large in this discussion, and we've heard a lot of that in recent weeks. Obviously, for me, unless the Bahamas gets electricity costs under control, one, it's very difficult to ease inflationary burdens on the average Bahamian, because electricity plays such an important, it's such a huge chunk of not just disposable income, but household budgets. And we pay dearly for electricity here, but for commercial and for business purposes, it's a real drag on investment. So the Bahamas couldn't think, for example, of taking advantage of onshoring, which is a buzzword that's been around in MDBs for a long, multilateral development banks, MDBs for a long time. How do you get some of this business that is, you know, manufacturing that would have been done in, let's say, the United States or some developed country to be relocated here? It's difficult to do that in places where electricity costs are so high. And even for our tourism industry experts, and I'm sure there's some of them on this call, in this Zoom, you know, 20, I think it's something like 23% of the cost of running a hotel is because of electricity. That's really, really, really high. And so switching to renewable energy is not just about being good for the planet, although I think that's probably the most important in my mind anyway. That's a very important goal. But the other goal has to be affordable energy, sustainable energy, and renewable energy as a way to drive the economy going forward. So I just wanted to say that. For me, a big part of the economy puzzle, the productivity puzzle, the GDP puzzle for the Bahamas is productivity. And productivity growth today can only be enhanced if we make better use of digital technology. And so this attempt at digital transformation, and I noticed in the budget, the biggest chunk of additional spending that was front-loaded in the first 6 months are going towards digital access for public services. This is really, really meaning equipment and software and so on to deliver more of the government's public services over the internet. Super, super important, not just because we can do things faster, more efficiently, but because we're living in 2025 now, And people want to be able to do as much as they can on a mobile device or, sitting from a laptop at home as opposed to, driving a car, pulling up to a government agency, going in, pulling up pieces of paper and trying to do transactions that way. That's really old-fashioned, very expensive, labor-intensive, and it's a drag on productivity. So I'm a huge fan that we should move more quickly and accelerate the digital transformation plans that were there even before COVID, but seem to have, I think, lost some steam given the other things that are on the agenda now. In terms of opportunities, next slide, please. I think we have to look at what's going on today around the globe. The Bahamas is a very small country. If nothing else, you may have heard in the last 48 hours about the world as a result of one policy action by the United States is how immediate the impact was felt across the globe. We are now an integrated economy. What happens in the US, obviously being the biggest country, biggest economy in the world, and such an important one with a reserve currency, whatever happens in the US economy has ripple effects everywhere. But I think in small countries like ours, while we, and this is sometimes where I get a little concerned about some of the rhetoric that I hear, not just politicians, but also people who sort of state these things. But the Bahamas cannot exist on its own. Everything we do has, most of what we eat, how we do things, everything is imported here. We don't even grow enough food to support ourselves in the event that we're cut off from the rest of the world. So think about how the Bahamas can play a role in the global economy that makes sense for Bahamians, but also that grows the pie for everyone. And here is where countries, small countries with limited natural commodities, we have sun, sand, sea, which we capitalize on a lot, but it's one industry, and we can't really eat our way just on tourism. We can't, that's not, it hasn't, while many jobs are associated with the tourism sector and there are ancillary jobs coming out of the financial sector, we know that the average Bahamian now graduating from university has other ideas about things that they want to do. And so, and because of technology, we can think about economic opportunities that are outside of these two sectors. So here is where we need to put our thinking caps on and really delve deeply into what that could be. We have very underdeveloped fintech, for example. We have very underdeveloped health tech. We have very underdeveloped agri tech. So there are a whole host of new emerging innovative sectors that other small countries are doing because they don't have commodities, and because they've managed to raise the skills of their human capital such that there are opportunities working across borders because of technology. So I put it out there that that's something that we ought to be thinking about. Clearly, we're going to be hit very, 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 very hard by the increase in tariffs. And not just because there's now a 10% on us. That's the least of the problem. The disruption is really going to come from what's happening in the rest of the world and how that's going to affect the global economy. We are not at all shielded from that. We can protect ourselves from that. What we have to do is make sure that we are, one, following the information, two, prepared to make some difficult choices. The one that I keep hearing from the administration this week is, oh, we need to find other ways to import food into the Bahamas. Well, while that's a really great idea, the logistics of shipping between, let's call it South America and the Caribbean, is underdeveloped. And while having spent 10 years at the IDB and thinking through how we can improve those integration efforts between Caribbean and Latin America, Central Latin America, we have not been able to do that. But there's a ton of space there for opportunities. And so I'm happy to hear it coming from the administration. But I just warn you, it's not easy to do. And in fact, yesterday I consulted one of my trade experts at IDB, and I said, look, this is what's being said. What do you think? And her view basically was, it hardly makes sense for the Bahamas. And that's because of where we're located. So we are so much tied into the logistics part of the United States that for shipping and maritime routes and so on, even our airlines, most of our flights are connected to North America. So it will take some time. The government needs to sit at the table, invite our European partners to say, what can we do? How can we get more airlift from Europe if the Americans won't? If there's going to be a crash in that economy, where can we get our visitors from quickly? And what can we do to diversify where our goods are coming from? And then, these are the two obvious ones, climate change and what's going to happen. I think we can never spend enough time thinking through what are the impacts. I think we all feel it every summer when it gets hotter and hotter and hotter, and we're all churning out or trying to use our air conditioning, and then there's a blackout and so on. But I think that's just that's a minor impact compared to what it's doing to, say, agriculture, what's it doing to our maritime resources and other things. And I think there's a whole body of work, research that we need to be doing. And because we're an archipelago, we ought to be at the forefront of that research and being a laboratory for looking for solutions. And then lastly, I just think we always have to be thinking about our economic implications, because not just because we know that it's almost silly season, election season and whatever it's called, but everything that the government does in terms of its spending, what choices it makes, what policies it takes to either make this economy more efficient or, drive a new drive towards renewable energy, those policies have implications. So if we're going to go that route, then what are the regulations in place? It's one thing to say we want to move to renewable energy, one thing to say we want to move to electric vehicles, but then there are a whole lot of regulatory issues in there. If we want to be doing more digital services for the public sector on the internet, what does that mean for the affordability of data and access to data and so on? So every single time that an announcement is made, we have to ask the questions, okay, it sounds good, but then apart from what we're hearing, what are the actual pathways to getting that done, and what's the legislation that's underpinning it, and what are the regulations that underpin it too? So I think that's it for trends, and I think I just end with some questions for you guys about, what did we see in this budget? Are we doing enough to achieve the objectives that were established by the current administration in terms of their own goals of fiscal transparency, accountability, and discipline? That's one question. Does this report help with transparency? I think it does. I think it can be simplified. I think the data needs to be presented in a more user-friendly way so that, I didn't have to have my calculator out and two computers and trying to figure things out by looking at different reports. But also, how this is communicated, and I'm very happy for this occasion tonight, because it shouldn't just be that it's the finance or the prime minister that's making these announcements. Obviously, civil society, the private sector, chamber of commerce, whomever, everybody should be talking about these issues. And I think maybe because the Bahamas hasn't been buffeted in a bad way, like some other countries in the region, where economic issues and how the government's spending its money is always in everyone's consciousness. I lived in Jamaica for 10 years, and I can tell you that this is a country where every single person on the street has a view about how the government's spending the money and whether that is appropriate or whether they should be putting it in this or that. And that's a good thing, because I think as taxpayers, everybody owns this, or we should own the narrative. We should be vested in a sustainable future for the country. And so asking these questions is appropriate, and asking them in a way that is, makes sense. It's not, I'm not asking the question because I think I'm one political stripe versus another political stripe. You're asking the questions because you're a citizen, you're interested, it's good governance that everybody be involved. And I think it makes, at the end of the day, it would make our politicians' lives a lot easier if Bahamians understood what they were saying. And then here again, in terms of improvements, you know, let's simplify it, let's break it down so that the people on Portis Key and the people in Maguana and wherever, you know, low-income Bahamians are residing, that they also see themselves in these documents and they feel like they own a piece of this interest. And I think ownership is a big piece of this. So that's my last thing.
One of the things that I find incredibly, well, first of all, let me say thank you to Therese for sharing with us on that webinar her insights into the mid-year budget statement and what lessons we can take from it, what insights she drew from it to highlight with us and to sort of shape our perception in a way that broadens the context of what can seem to be a, I suppose, less than useful communication from the executive directorate or the executive branch of our government. But the reality is that statements like the mid-year budget statement are crucially, critically, incredibly important because they tell us what the government has chosen as its priorities for how it spends the public funds. And the thing about politics in the Bahamas, the thing about governance all over the world, is that we have a saying here in the Bahamas, mouth could say anything, right? And I remember there's another statement, I learned this one from C.A. Smith when he was serving as the Bahamas' ambassador to the United States and the permanent representative to the OAS at the embassy in Washington. And I was serving as a press and cultural attaché at the embassy at the time. And one time, C.A. and I were sitting down in the basement of the embassy talking about talking about politics and policy. And what he said to me was that his mother had taught him a very interesting lesson when he was a boy about paper. Because, I remember now. What we were talking about is what makes a Bahamian. Because there had been an immigration question posed. And he asked me what I thought made somebody a Bahamian, or what I thought a Bahamian was. And I gave this, you know, I gave the, I guess what we would call the standard answer at the time. And I'm very curious, you know, about whether or not his answer or mine would have changed in the intervening time. This would have been 2011, maybe 2010, somewhere around there. And wow, what time certainly does fly. Anyway, so what he said was that something that is written in paper, he said that his mummy told him when he was a boy that paper will lay down and let anybody write anything on it. And I think in the context of the current conversation about the mid-year budget statement, you know, it is one of those few pieces of paper where it isn't just about what was written on it, but it tells you, because this is what I was starting to say, right, is that in politics and in governance, Maut could say anything. You could say whatever you want to say, but how you spend the money is really how the citizens should be judging what your real priorities are. Because you spend the money on your priorities. And that's why these kinds of communications are so important. And that's why I really enjoyed Therese walking us through her impressions of the mid-year budget statement. So this Glenturret 10-year-old peat smoke is one of the tastiest peated whiskeys that I've had in a long time. It's a very refined character that really leaves a flavor of, as I said, you know, that the smokiness and earthiness of mushrooms, a little bit of that, you know, like, I don't know if you guys have, like, fresh cut grass, but when that fresh cut grass has been sitting in the sun a little bit, it almost has that, it evokes that kind of sensation in my experience. So firstly, again, thanks to Therese Turner Jones for her wisdom and insight. I hope you enjoyed listening to what she had to say at the webinar, and thanks to ORG for putting the webinar on. And I really hope that you go out and find a bottle of the Glenturret. If you like peated whiskeys, the 10-year-old peated is incredible. And I look forward to the next time we get together. I think Matthew and I'll be together by then. And thank you so much for listening to the Sunday Scotch Society. It's really one of my favorite things to do. Alrighty, as I say, when Matt is around, Dad's Vidanya.
Check it out.